This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Hear about the impact of a law that is supposed to reduce race-based disparities in student discipline and Illinois schools. Not all that successfully, though.
A lot of black students were suspended for minor offenses, but for longer periods of time.
Illinois State University professor Charles Bell says his research shows that differences in discipline make absenteeism, dropout rates, and educational attainment less for blacks than whites. Plus, State Representative Dan Brady talks with WGLT's Ryan Denham about his role on the Property Tax Relief Task Force. That's something lawmakers wanted to look at, as well as a graduated income tax. Laura Kennedy is barefoot in the park with community players. And correspondent Colleen Reynolds updates us on the Habitat for Humanity Hero House. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This year, when lawmakers decide to ask voters whether they want to dump Illinois' flat income tax for a graduated model, they also agree to take a look at property taxes. State Representative Dan Brady is a member of the new Property Tax Relief Task Force. The Bloomington Republican tells WGLT's Ryan Denham they started meeting this month and are divvying up the work into seven subcommittees covering hot-button issues like school funding and local pensions.
Rather unique here with the task force. There's over 80 members, 8-0, between the House and the Senate. And so just the mere organizational side of things, is challenging when you have video conference calls going on and task force, people in Chicago, Springfield, folks at different locations, it makes for some challenges. Those subcommittees are part of the agenda, if you will, of things we're looking at. And we're due back to have a report to the General Assembly and the governor at the end of December. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of work lies ahead for this group with the subject matter I just gave you and the complication of the size and of the committee from one standpoint, but the complication and in-depthness of the subject matter itself is very technical.
The task force was born out of a pretty busy spring legislative session when lawmakers agreed to ask voters whether to enact a progressive or graduated income tax, the thinking being that, okay, overhauling the income tax is an opportunity here to potentially alleviate some of the property tax burden. So how would you describe the goal of this task force?
How do we become a state that can stabilize and reduce property tax and yet still provide services? And how do we continue to look at the ever-rising cost of property tax as it relates to public schools throughout the state of Illinois? And I think we have to, first off, as we started to do, was to look at the history side of things, Ryan, and that is, the Illinois Constitution has contained a provision for taxing property in direct proportion to value since 1818. And since 1933, property taxes have been levied at the local level. Personal property tax for individuals was eliminated in 1969, and personal property tax for businesses entities was eliminated in 1979. Business entities now pay a personal property replacement tax, which is referred to as the PPRT. So, from a historic perspective, we look at those things. We look at the seven subcommittee subject matters that I've alluded to, and how do we pull that together to have a more efficient system from a taxing body standpoint? And a big portion of the local side of this whole equation for the way that the property tax is assessed, the role of the assessors and the role of the local government. And then as it pertains to the state, it seems, when people have property tax appeal issues and go to the state board, if you will, it seems that it's all shifted back on its local authority, local control in that area. And so I think we need to try and find and clarify for the taxpayer, first off, what the rights truly are, and then secondly, can we come up with some type of different formula that hasn't been looked at for centuries in this state?
What do you hear from your constituents about property taxes? How much of a burden is it really, in the words of the people that you talk to every day?
I think you'd hear from anybody, I pay too much property tax.
That's the prevailing
number one. We just, at the committee hearing yesterday, we had a portion at the end of the task force meeting for public comment. And, of course, the public comment, no one stood up and said, gee, my property taxes are right where I'd like to see them in the state of Illinois. No, it was a complaint time. And one of the things, as I alluded to earlier, some of the complaint was the confusion of, on a state level, what really the authority of the Department of Revenue is and what it isn't. And there's also, there's not a mechanism in statute that I'm aware of from the standpoint of referendum-wise to increase what the threshold is of what can be charged in the 5%. But you don't have any mechanism in statute to reduce taxes from a property tax standpoint, unless there's PTEL. And
what is PTEL, just for our listeners?
PTEL is, some counties have elected to have a area in which that they've capped, if you will, the tax side of things. And the PTEL is designed to limit the increases in property tax extension of the total taxes that are billed in qualifying jurisdictions for non-home rule districts. So does not cap individual property tax bills or property assessment, but allows a taxing district to receive limited inflationary increase in extensions on existing property, plus an additional amount for new construction. Limiting that, you can see just that definition of what I just talked to you about, PTEL, which referred to as the Property Tax Extension Limitation Law, is confusing in itself. And you know, for your average citizen out paying their property taxes, understanding this maze, if you will, of things related to property taxes, is something that's very confusing for most. How do we simplify a system? How do we try and reduce or cap where property taxes are and still provide services? And under the PTEL, it can be increased for a taxing body with voter approval. So there you go. You've got the approval to increase, but there's nothing in statute to talk about decrease. So what do we need to look at from a legislative standpoint to say we need to have that mechanism in there, if not statewide, home rule authority or counties that want to do something different? Obviously, then you run into the local schools who will tell you the only stability we have is that local property tax. Be very careful what you do or don't do here. And the last thing you do, don't send anything to Springfield that we have to turn around and try and get back from you.
So this task force is sort of predicated on the belief that property taxes are increasingly burdensome across Illinois. Yeah, but here in Bloomington-Normal, we've got Unit 5, our biggest school district, saying publicly, hey, we don't have enough money. We've got to do a referendum, or we've got to do a sales tax, or we're going to be cutting a lot of teachers. So how do you square those two things? How could both of those things be true at the same time?
Well, it's very difficult. You have, in a situation of Unit 5, you have obviously a growing district. I believe this year the school has over 250-some more students, for a total of well over 13,000-some students throughout Unit 5. And when you have growth like that, you have growth on the operations side of your district. And when you go to the property tax side of things as your most stable source and your largest source of funding, and you have the ability of levying and increasing and doing things, the growth continues from that standpoint, and you go on to the property tax. Do we look at something that could be done, shifted more sales tax-wise? Do we look at some other type of funding of what the General Assembly does within their operating budget that we just did recently? Do we look at some way of what we appropriate to schools for the operational side of things, of doing something different there? The property side of things continues to be, in my opinion, the number one source of discussion and the thing that's noticed the most by the homeowner, obviously. So when you have these growing school districts and they go back to the property tax side of things and they talk about these referendums, those are all things that we're going to be dealing with and trying to see, is there a better way to do this? Is there a better way that we can provide school funding, stable school funding somehow, and not do it by increased side of property taxes again? That discussion will go on, but it's very difficult, as you alluded to, when you have school districts that have the growth, you know, on a local level, where are they looking at to try and control their cost? And I'm sure that they, you know, could point to examples, but it takes money to run the schools, and when the schools have large growth, you're going to have the request for more money.
Are there downsides to potentially shifting to other sources of revenue, you know, moving toward a more heavier reliance on sales taxes or state income taxes? Those things, you know, I assume would fluctuate with the economy in a very specific way. You might see, you know, if the economy plummets, sales taxes would go alongside that. Is there a downside to moving to that type of model?
Well, first off, I think everything's on the table. Is there a downside? Sure. There's a downside to the way we're doing it now. There's a downside to what we may change. And quite frankly, you know, Springfield doesn't have exactly the greatest history of enacting some of the things that are positive, maybe well-intended, but ill-intended consequences come from a lot of things that come out of state government. And the idea that we come back with at least a report, it's not that we're saying we're taking this to the full General Assembly and we're going to have a vote on it, you know, next spring. We're coming up with a report with ideas. And where those ideas go from there, that's going to be the responsibility of and up to the responsibility of individual legislators per se, the governor's administration, the very body itself of revenue, and the Department of Revenue. So there's downsides to all this, but I think the biggest downside would be not looking and trying to come up with some ideas to make things better.
Well, task forces are a tricky thing. We've seen locally there have been task forces appointed for all sorts of causes and efforts, and sometimes they're dead ends. They don't produce results. They may produce a report, but not actual results. What are your hopes for this particular body? You said it's pretty cumbersome. There's more than 80 members to it. Do you think it's actually gonna lead to real change, not just a report?
I don't know. I guess you could go back to the Eichenberg report under Governor Edgar of school funding in the state. What did that change? Really, I've told you the history of our taxation and property tax in the state. It was a lot of work, and it did not necessarily change a great deal of things. And a couple of the ideas maybe have been implemented, but I don't think anyone could tell you that that report, with all the work that was done, had any lightning rod that came out of it. Do we run the same risk here? Absolutely. But I think the greater risk, as I said, is doing nothing and not looking at it and just letting property taxes to continue to rise.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with State Representative Dan Brady, a Republican who represents parts of Bloomington Normal. So let's pivot to a school safety bill that you worked on, just signed into law, that will assist districts in locking down classrooms in the event of an active shooter situation. So what does this new law do exactly?
What the law does is allows local school boards school districts, if you will, to have the ability, doesn't mandate, doesn't say they have to do it, but allows them to be able to utilize the what are now newer inserts into the locking mechanism of a door that can lock that door from the inside. In some of our older schools, and in particular, this was bill was brought to myself and Senator Chapin Rose from a school district, that if, in fact, there was a situation in that school to secure that classroom, a teacher has to go outside with that wad of keys and lock that door from the outside in the hallway. Obviously, if you have the problem you're trying to stay away from in the hallway, you are walking right out into the problem, trying to provide safety to those students that are inside that classroom. A couple of things that we had to do in order to do that was we had to find common ground in the state fire marshal's office and some of the codes within fire marshal's public safety codes for schools. And then we also had to amend the school code itself. And so while everyone wants safety and wants to, you know, do everything they possibly can for our students and our faculty and staff, there were some things that had to be changed that and you get to the fine print in the school code and the state fire marshal's code that we had to change, and we did under the legislation. And again, the legislation now allows for these insert locks to be used for the purpose of public safety.
So you mentioned this is not a mandate. This is all that does is give the option for school districts, school boards to pursue these. How much do these insert locks cost if somebody wants to proceed with putting like one on one door? Ballpark.
I wanted to say somewhere in the area of $40 to $50 you're talking about. Now, that can get up there higher than that. Obviously, when you're talking about trying to retrofit an entire school. But some of the schools that still have that, fortunately, a lot of our schools don't have this issue, but some of the older school buildings that do, at least this gives them an option, a feasible option, hopefully from a financial standpoint, something that they can do.
Do you sense a lot of anxiety among teachers and administrators that you talk to about school violence, the potential for one of these situations popping up one day in their building?
The world we live in now, you never say never. Is it something that is on their mind daily? I don't know that, but having a sister who's a school teacher, certainly they have those concerns and are apprehensive and want to have the greatest technology there to protect the students and protect faculty and staff. And so how this weighs on someone's mind, especially in an older school building, we hope that it's a help from a safety measure and something that is manageable for that school district from a finance.
That's State Representative Dan Brady, a Republican who represents parts of Bloomington-Normal. Dan, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Nice to be with you as always.
I'm Ryan Denham.
You'll find more politics and government coverage at our website, WGLT.org. Just click on the drop-down menu under News.
WGLT is a service of Illinois State University. Illinois State's home of Bloomington-Normal ranks as one of the top college towns in America based on its quality of life. It's also ranked as a top five destination among smaller communities in the U.S. for recent college grads. More at illinoisstate.edu/pointsofpride. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, we have GLT correspondent Laura Kennedy barefoot in the park with community players. School discipline systems are driving minority students away from school. That's a conclusion of research done by ISU professor Charles Bell. There's a lot of research showing differences in discipline based on race. For instance, ProPublica found last year that white students in Unit 5 in District 87 are 3.6 times more likely to be enrolled in advanced placement courses than African American students. ProPublica also notes black students are 4.6 times more likely to be suspended than white students in Unit 5. In District 87, it's 3.5 times more likely to be suspended. 4 years ago, the state even passed a law trying to even out that difference by having more restorative discipline to reduce suspensions. But Bell says there has not been a lot done on the perceptions and impacts of the differences. He says there are qualitative differences in suspensions as well.
In many cases, black students are disproportionately suspended for more violent offenses, and even for nonviolent offenses. So in some instances, black students may engage in a status offense, dress code, for example. You come to school, you're out of dress code. A white student may not get suspended for that. Black student gets sent home, they get suspended for that. So those are the kind of disparities that we typically see in school discipline.
And length of suspensions for offenses of a similar nature.
Mm-hmm. So length of suspensions was a really important issue where a lot of black students were suspended for minor offenses, but for longer periods of time. So one good example of this is challenging an educator on an assignment, thinking or articulating that you felt that the assignment was sort of biased in a way or was insensitive to a cultural aspect, and that resulted in a 10-day suspension. When we think about the significance of that, that's 10 school days where that student is out of class, they're off track. And many students stated that they could not compensate for that missed instruction. That instruction was so important for them to stay on task, to feel a sense of belonging and purpose in the school setting, that when they returned after the 10-day suspension, they had a lot of difficulty catching up. And many students stated they never caught up. I can tell you that feelings of belonging in school were significantly impacted by the school suspensions and overall sort of districts. So a lot of students and parents felt that My child was being targeted in this particular school, so they were removing their children from schools and engaging in what I call black educational flight. So continuously moving and relocating different districts here in Illinois, searching for a place where they felt that their child would not be subjected to excessive school discipline.
Is there a correlation from low feelings about school to participation in school?
Yes, there's a lot of research that says that school belonging, feeling that your presence is valued, feeling that your ideas are valued, and that you are an important aspect and respected member of the school culture, definitely has a strong correlation to participation in school, forming positive friendships and relationships with educators, and just having an overall successful schooling experience.
Does the school flight and the increased absenteeism caused by the difference in, or that also correlates to the difference in school discipline records, have an impact on educational attainment? I mean, for instance, ProPublica found that the achievement gap for African American students in Unit 5 was 2.6 grades, and in District 87, it's 2.7 grades, even though District 87 has a higher African American share of the student body than Unit 5 does. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So a lot of times when students are suspended for those long periods of time, they come back to school, they are completely disconnected from the environment, and then they get another suspension for either talking in class, relatively minor suspensions, and they accumulate. And what happens is that student is eventually transferred to an alternative school setting where they then have to compete with those students who are in the advanced placement classes and they're in an alternative school that doesn't really have those kind of resources. And that's a huge challenge for many families. How do you compete with that? It's impossible.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Illinois State University Professor Charles Bell about race-based discrepancies in discipline and in educational attainment among students in the state of Illinois. School officials know about this. They don't like it, if they're worth anything. They don't like it. Mm-hmm. How is it that teachers, most of whom are of good faith as well, are still doing this, are still saying, okay, I'm going to this data point is in isolation, you're going to be suspended. This data point is in isolation, you're not being suspended. And you end up with a whole bunch of data points that indicates that there's a huge race-based problem there. Mm-hmm. Why is it happening?
So in Illinois, and I actually conducted a similar study in Michigan, I just found the Illinois terrain just to be very different here. First, Illinois is probably more progressive in school discipline reform, shockingly, than most other places. I would also say that in many instances, this was a building or school-based phenomenon where some schools actually took the reform law really seriously and they were aggressively trying to reduce suspensions, where other schools completely disregarded it. They didn't care. They felt that suspensions were the only way that they could actually remove students who were problematic from the school setting. They also felt that the law had no enforcement. So what are you going to do to me? I'm going to suspend students. There's a law. I'm going to violate this law. There's no enforcement of the law.
This is the law that the state of Illinois passed.
Yes, the Senate Bill 100 law.
Okay. And this restorative discipline law, this progressive discipline law, has it had an impact?
I would say in certain areas it has. There are definitely some schools where upon entering the school and looking at their data, you can definitely tell that there's been a significant decline in school suspensions. But there are some districts and some schools within those districts that they felt, and this is a really interesting phenomenon, where they felt that if they could not suspend the students, it took away their only mechanism for discouraging problematic behavior. And it actually created an environment where teachers felt that they would be threatened. In a sense, where they couldn't suspend a student, so they felt that the students knew they wouldn't get in trouble, and it would embolden the students to continue to engage in this behavior, which is sort of an interesting phenomenon, and it just enabled them to continue.
So it's viewing the students as a problem as an enemy, as an opponent.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you going to teach people if you view them that way?
Exactly. How can you teach children that you are afraid of and you fear and you're, yeah.
Are there commonalities in the districts that have ignored the law, that have not changed the way they approach student discipline?
Oh, definitely more predominantly African-American school districts, poor or impoverished communities, and or working class communities, things of that nature, where it would kind of get swept under the rug and sort of normalized in a sense, where this is just how we do things here.
This may be a fruitless question, but it's an interesting one to ask, and there may not be sufficient data available to answer, but here goes. There's a high correlation between lack of educational attainment and likelihood of discipline and low-income status, regardless of race. Mm-hmm. Are there discrepancies in disciplinary action between whites and African Americans of similar income?
Mm-hmm. That's something I do not have data on specifically in Illinois. However, there were studies conducted previously, and they're probably a little outdated at this point, that shows that in the same socioeconomic status, income area, black students are disproportionately suspended.
Still.
Yeah.
Well, how do you get at that problem?
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting question, and I think that we have to find the root of the issue, which is, in many districts, it's different. Some it's just, you know, a fear, a sort of fear or a rush to remove certain students. And we have to have some sort of cross-cultural competence training as to why are we afraid of the attire of a student? Where does this social imagery play into our conditioning of students and our response to their behaviors and suspensions and expulsions and things like that.
So what does attire mean? Is that potentially gang clothing?
No, or? For example, the infamous hooded sweatshirt. Some teachers see that and they automatically attribute that to being a thug or being gang oriented, and it doesn't necessarily have those connotations. It could be a student who's impoverished. It could be a student who's homeless. And that hoodie is not only their coat, their shirt, it could be their pillow at night. And I think those are things that we have to really consider. You know, there are reasons why people wear certain attire, and that doesn't necessarily make them bad people or dangerous people.
Were those districts that have refused to dip their toe in the water on this front at significantly higher risk of student-on-teacher or student-on-adult violence?
I would not say that that's the case. What I would say is that a lot of the teacher fears were sort of unwarranted. A lot of the teacher fears were stemming from environmental situations that resonated or originated outside of the school where teachers felt unsafe. And those perceptions of the students, given their attire, the infamous hooded sweatshirt, carried over to the students in the school. So a good example of this is a teacher may have gotten carjacked in school or robbed on a school grounds. And that sort of persona, that fear, would translate over to a student who's in class and has a hooded sweatshirt and maybe asks a question, and it's perceived to be a threatening manner, and that student's suspended.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Our guest is ISU Professor Charles Bell. We're talking about racial differences in the application of disciplinary codes among Illinois schools. You mentioned cross-cultural education, but are there other ways to get administrators to buy into the new law and to say, we need to implement this as best as possible, and we need to push our faculty to become conversant with how this works?
Mm-hmm. I think that administrators who have not bought in already, we need to have a conversation as to why they have not bought in already. And usually it's from opposition from educators. And I think they're opposing it in their classrooms just because they don't have, they can't think or they don't know another mechanism to regulate their classes. When we think about racial disparities in school suspensions, this isn't something that's been going on for 5 years. This is something that we can trace back all the way, 30, 40 years ago. And it's almost like it's ingrained in teachers where they come into districts and they learn that this is how we handle things. This is a culture that's been established, and it's not going to go away overnight. This is something that we have to really work at, continue to find solutions and dig deep into why we want to suspend students, despite all the research that we know shows that when we suspend students, they are off task, they have lower educational attainment, and it increases their rate of incarceration or risk of incarceration. Why do we want to suspend?
among the school districts that have started to see the needle move on this, that have taken to heart and really aggressively tried to implement the restorative parts of the new discipline law, do we know what they're doing right and how they're doing it and how portable that is?
I could speak to that just a little bit. From what I've seen is, first, their understanding of the research in terms of a school suspension increases the risk of incarceration. I think just acknowledging that and accepting that we have to do something different, because our ultimate goal as an educator or as an administrator and as a school is to put students on a positive track. By suspending them, we are sort of undoing that positive track and placing them on a negative track. So acknowledging and owning that suspensions are not the solution but are part of the problem is one key thing that I see in common with all those districts. The willingness to try something different, whether it's something that's evidence-based or something that is coming out of an idea, I think that's something that's really novel or in common. Some districts, when I walked in the door, they said, we're trying this, we don't know if it's going to work, but we're willing to try something. And that's the key. Other districts were completely resistant to the idea of trying anything. They were really steadfast in that we're going to suspend students because we don't have an alternative. We view our student population as dangerous. And if we don't suspend, we could get harmed. So,
do lawmakers need to go back and tweak the law? Do they need to put teeth into it since there, as you pointed out, there is no downside for non-implementation?
That's exactly what I think needs to happen. I think the law needs to be revisited, and that's the purpose of this panel that I'm hosting, is just to put students on a panel along with legislators and allow the students to speak, because you can hear it from a researcher, and I have the research to support it, but hearing it from the students who've been affected by this directly, knowing that the law was passed in 2015, and here in 2019, we're still hearing student accounts that, hey, I was suspended for 10 days for a minor violation. No fight, no physical fights, just a minor disagreement. I think that's a significant issue that needs to be addressed in the law.
What are a couple of the districts who have had some success in changing the culture and changing the way outcomes are happening?
I know Bloomington is working towards some solutions, and they were definitely entertaining the fact that school discipline is a problem, that they own the fact that they had some racial issues and racial disparities in school discipline, and they were willing to try something new. I actually submitted a Freedom of Information Act request and required some of their data, and you can definitely see a downward trend in Bloomington High School and things like other things like that.
How much of a trend?
It was noticeable. I wouldn't say that it was pretty significant, but it was definitely a downward trend.
Illinois State University researcher Charles Bell presents some of his data on race-based differences and how school discipline systems drive African-American students away from education and alienate them from the school experience. That is today at Schrader Hall, room 130 on ISU's campus. Also, as part of the Opportunity Suspended Forum, you can hear from students and lawmakers who helped draft the 2015 reform law. You'll hear WGLT coverage of that panel discussion Tuesday on Sound Ideas. Bell also notes the road to expulsion is much easier in Illinois than in Michigan. Often expulsion happens after 3 suspensions in this state. In Michigan, it's up to 20. He says, on the other hand, Illinois is trying to enact reform, Michigan mostly not, even though both states passed reform bills the same year.
Support for GLT comes from CEFQ, partnering with car dealers throughout central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers, online pre-approval is available. CEFQ, not a bank, better. Details at CEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. In just a few minutes, Colleen Reynolds checks in with Habitat for Humanity. Community Players invites you to kick off your shoes and feel the grass between your toes, metaphorically speaking, for their latest production. It's a Broadway classic with a timeless look at marriage. WGLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
Boy meets girl. Boy marries girl. Boy, does that ever change things. Community Players presents a classic comedy from Neil Simon, opening with a preview September 5th and running through the 15th. It's Barefoot in the Park. Playing newlyweds Paul and Corey Bratter are Dakota McDaniels and Caleb Blue. The director is Opal Virtue, who says this Neil Simon classic was a good fit for her directorial skill set.
I always look for something with a smaller cast. That seems to be my passion, a more intimate group of people to work with.
So is it easy money to do a Neil Simon play?
Yeah, they're popular, especially with our older crowd. So they always look forward to a Neil Simon show. The story revolves around Corey and Paul Bratter, who are newlyweds. The show starts with them being married 6 days ago. They're just coming back from their honeymoon into a walk-up apartment on the fifth floor in New York. Paul never saw this apartment. He saw one on the third floor. And so it just starts with an empty apartment, and they're waiting for the furniture to come. Corey is a very glass-half-full kind of girl. She sees the fun and excitement in everything, and Paul is not. And so once the honeymoon is over, the story starts to show the differences between them.
They seem to be kind of a odd couple, if I may use that phrase.
Yes, they are. Very much opposites attract kind of situation. I think she's just very young at heart. She looks at everything with rose-colored glasses, can always see the good in anything, looks forward to any kind of adventure. And Paul is just not that way at all. Adventure scares him. The unknowns causes him stress. He just likes status quo.
So you're the young newlyweds of Barefoot in the Park. Why did you want to be in this show? Why did you want to play Corey?
I was interested in the role because throughout my theatrical experience, I haven't had a chance to portray a character like Corey. This is my first foray into contemporary or modern theater, and it was a challenging opportunity as well as one that I looked forward to taking on.
So are you accustomed to doing like Shakespeare and things like that?
That's right. I have a master's in Shakespeare and performance. I recently played Florizel in The Winter's Tale, as well as Don John in Much Ado About Nothing.
How do you like doing Neil Simon?
I don't care for it.
Okay. Why not?
I have a penchant for theater that leaves the audience with a clear resolution.
Oh, okay. Oh, so we're not going to have as much of a clear resolution with this play. Is that a little heads up there?
I would say so. There's definitely sort of an open-endedness to the show in particular.
Okay. But, well, Dakota, why did you want to play Paul?
Well, I'm a huge fan of Neil Simon.
Okay, well, how cozy.
By contrast. I've done a few other Neil Simon shows, Rumors and Lost in Yonkers, and I think Paul as a character really appeals to me because we are very similar, just sort of boring vanilla individuals.
See, I like vanilla. I don't think it's boring.
Oh yeah, it's nice to just sort of sit back and be the guy that things happen to, not have to make them happen yourself.
So if Dakota is, as Paul, vanilla, then Kayla, what are you as Corey, as an ice cream flavor?
Tie-dye.
Tie-dye. What's that taste like?
Tastes like raspberries.
Just raspberries?
No, it tastes like raspberries, mint, blueberry, lemon, and grape all at once.
You know, the impression I have of Corey, you know, I saw the film many, many years ago, and I saw a stage version of that. And I think in modern terms, when I think of Corey, the phrase manic pixie comes to mind. Do you think is that on target?
I think that's apt. Manic has a negative connotation sometimes, but I think for Corey it might be positive.
And of course, Paul is eternal. Paul is like a blue blazer.
Oh, absolutely. A pretty consistent character that I think you could find in just about any genre or any time period.
Where does the humor come from in this play? Is it character driven? I mean, everyone knows that if you want a good snarky line, you can always depend on Neil Simon.
It is character driven. The comedy comes from the differences between Paul and Corey, and then we throw in Corey's mother, who is much more like Paul than Corey. She doesn't understand Corey at all. And then throw in their upstairs neighbor, Mr. Velasco, who is just kind of a kook, and he will do anything and everything. And Corey decides it's a good idea to set her mom and Mr. Velasco up on a blind date.
So that's an even more opposites attract thing going on there.
Very much.
So what makes a marriage work? What are we learning in this play about what makes marriage work?
I think what makes marriage work is compromise. Corey learns that she has, well, one of the lines, and although it kind of makes you go, when it's said because of this day and age, I do think it's true. She says that you have to give up a small part of yourself when you get married. And, you know, like I said, people are going to go, well, what? But I think it's true. You have to give and take. And she said, you know, if you want adventure and excitement and play your little games, do that in the bedroom at night. But during the day, do what you can to make him happy.
For me, I would say taking your time, making sure you know who you're entering into this agreement with, because that is one of the things that this couple sort of struggles with. They end up feeling like maybe they didn't spend enough time getting to know each other before they made that leap. So definitely taking your time.
Kayla, do you feel that opposites attract, and can that be lasting?
I do agree that opposites attract. I find that adage to be very true with this play. However, maybe sometime their magnetic pole switched for Corey somewhere in the middle of the play, and what was once alluring and attractive to Paul became the opposite.
Well, the play was originally written in the early 60s. Are you keeping it set there?
I'm setting it at 1966. It was written in 1963, I believe. Part of that is I wanted to use the song Born Free because I just think that is Corey, and we're opening the show with that, so I wanted it set in 66 so I could use that music.
So the play offers us an opportunity to learn perhaps about a way to meet in the middle with these two very different people. Is this an important message for right now?
Oh, I think very much. I think it's important that we learn to get along, find the common ground in any relationship. And I think Neil Simon is really good at that. He writes almost every play about relationships and dysfunction within those relationships, but yet he always finds a way to bring it back to a good place.
You know, Neil Simon was pretty much a giant of theater in the latter half of the 20th century, but how do you feel Neil Simon is going to endure in the 21st century? We lost him in 2018, and so will his works live on, do you believe, Opal?
I think they will. I think he just seems to let us know that no matter what happens, it can be okay. He's always, like, this show is set in the 60s, and of course in the 60s was a major year of change, or a decade of change, but it was just starting. We were going to the moon, we were going to war, women were starting to come forward and say, hey, look at me. And in this particular show, Corey just thrives on that, that she's just so excited about everything that's happening in the world. And I think in all of his plays, he does that and shows us that even though change can be difficult, it's good and we'll work through it.
Opal, would you go barefoot in the park?
I absolutely would. I see Corey and myself a lot. I am the glass half full. Rose-colored glasses can make good out of any situation and use humor a lot. So I see myself in Corey.
And you see yourself barefoot in the park.
I do.
That's Opal Virtue, director of Barefoot in the Park, starring Kayla Blue and Dakota McDaniels, opening with a preview September 5th and running through the 15th at Community Players Theater in Bloomington. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Community Players rates Barefoot in the Park at PG. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. 8 months ago, McLean County Habitat for Humanity announced it was naming its first ever Hero House in honor of Army Sergeant Josh Rogers, who was killed in Afghanistan through his third tour of duty in 2017. The house is now under construction on South Oak Street near Wood in Bloomington, and WGLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds talks with Habitat construction manager Bill Waller about Habitat plans to keep up with an ambitious home building agenda in the future and about community support for the Rogers House.
We're up on the second floor framing right now, getting ready to set trusses. I was able to find and discover a project director that was a disabled military person, and we're working with him to expand his knowledge and give him new life. And in the way things are, he had PTSD, and he's learning how to cope, and we're teaching him how to cope, and he's running our crew right now. So it's a fabulous thing. The project has amazed me in so many different directions, Colleen. The groups and organizations coming out are also, you know, learning about Josh and about the life that he lived. And that's really one of the things that's the beauty of this project. It is. It's just drawing the whole community together. I meet people every day down in that neighborhood that want to know more about what we're doing. And
talk about the location of the house, and if people are interested in maybe organizing a small group and they'd like to come out and help you, where is it and how can they sign up?
It's down on South Oak Street in Bloomington. It's the only new construction house in that neighborhood, and they can go to HabitatMcLean.org, and there's a volunteer link there, and they can click on that. We have openings in September. It fills up pretty fast, though. Every time the month changes, it fills up really fast because people want to, you know, be a part of this thing, and it's a wonderful thing that they do. I mean, we're planning on building more houses in the future. I mean, Habitat has plans to expand from 6 this year to 8 next year to 10 the following year, and we're going to need more volunteers. And this is serving as a platform to get those volunteers in the house because, like I said, once we get you involved, you come back. That's just the way that is. We'd love to get the youth involved as well, and that's the reason we go off-site and build these walls like we did with these walls. They were built at the VFW over on Morrissey Avenue. Kids were able to get involved, and if we get youth involved, it's a fabulous thing because volunteerism starts when you're young, and if you start when you're young, you continue to volunteer for the rest of your life, and that's what our organization is built on.
And if somebody doesn't necessarily feel comfortable swinging a hammer, using a saw, they don't have to necessarily support that way. There are other ways, even on site, they can support.
Absolutely, but we're teachers as well. That's one of the things that I pride myself on. Whatever I'm like Job in the patience thing, and I've learned, and I've become a teacher of people and to educate them and to enable them to do the things that they need to do. You experienced it at Women's Bill.
Sure. Measure twice, cut once.
You see, it's stuck with you all these years. So it's like falling off a bike.
And it was also nice, too, though, every once in a while, if I couldn't get there till a little bit later, I'd bring the snacks or the drinks or whatever. That's another way people can support.
All kinds of ways to support Habitat. We make it easy for you to support Habitat.
So the Hero House, this is the first year, but this is a program that's going to continue, and you are opening up the application process again. So tell us about that.
That's right. It's open now until September 15th, and we're going to have another selection process for the next Hero. Honestly, and I shared the story before how I found Vonda and how, you know, we talked about building the house in her son's honor. And honestly, that was a selection process at that time in my mind. But I've got a committee now, and we've decided that we need to make this equal and fair across the community because there truly is a lot of heroes in this community, and we want to honor all of them at one point or another, but individually. So we've opened up the process. It's simple, straightforward. You'll find the form on either your Heroes of Habitat Facebook or Habitat for Humanity Facebook, or on our website, HabitatMcLean.org, you'll find it there as well. So we've got it out in the community, and that's one of the reasons I'm here today, to spread that message.
And the deadline for getting that done?
September 15th.
And it's not arduous.
No, it's a really simple form. There are like 2 questions. We want your information, then there are like 2 or 3 questions on the form. Actually, it's nothing to it. We want to know about the person. That's what we're curious about. That's how we're deciding who our hero is. What have you done for the community?
Well, we know that, you know, a lot of volunteer labor goes into these Habitat homes. You do get a lot of materials donated, but they still cost a significant amount of money. And you're always fundraising, and you've got a big event coming up, and we want to make sure people mark their calendars because this is going to be a great event.
This is going to be fabulous. We're going to be in the Castle Theater with Fiona Way, and Fiona Way is made up of some people at State Farm, execs and the like, that have formed a band, and their mission statement says, you know, we'll help raise money for non-for-profits. Vonda works at State Farm, so they knew her, and that led to conversation with me, and it was a meeting point that was just great. And I could feel the electricity of that conversation as we were going along, and they were beginning to understand and get a buy-in for it. So it's going to be a high-energy night that night at the Castle Theater. There are going to be a lot of good people in the room there, and we hope to raise some significant monies to help fund these houses into the future.
What kind of music?
Do you know? I don't know, actually, but I suspect it's some, you know, pretty good stuff all the way around. I mean, these guys go all over the country and play these venues and events to raise money for charity.
And again, it's October 12th, and how much is the ticket?
The tickets are a mere $15. We want you inside so you can hear the message that they're going to deliver to you and the power they are able to deliver about what's going on, and we hope to open some purse strings that way. Additionally, there will be some auction items, but nothing, you know, that's not the significant reason we're there that night.
Habitat Construction Manager Bill Waller speaking about Habitat for Humanity with WGLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham, Colleen Reynolds, and Laura Kennedy. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. If you like Sound Ideas, you're going to like WGLT's The Leadoff. It's our daily morning podcast. Every new episode has the daily news, the important calendar items, and still manages to give a little extra time to our leadoff story. Start your day with WGLT's daily morning podcast, The Leadoff. Learn more at WGLT.org/leadoff. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's Public Media.